Good evening, this is Activism Hour on Signal Radio. We have three interviews, one with Brim de Winter about WikiLeaks, of course, followed with Smari McCarthy from the International Modern Media Initiative, which is not about WikiLeaks, and then with Adam Katz, International Director of EFF, and it's again about WikiLeaks. Enjoy.
Brim, nice to have you again.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here again.
Well, the unavoidable question, of course, is what do you think about WikiLeaks?
I think it's a very interesting, cool site. I read a lot of interesting documents over there. And I'm very happy that they are out there. For me as a journalist, this is documents heaven.
Okay, and how do you feel about Anonymous feeling a need to defend Julian Assange by DDoSing MasterCard.com, for example?
It's interesting as a development. It would have been useful, maybe more useful, if they would have hacked systems and got some documents and made them public. That would be more in the WikiLeaks style. I don't think that ultimately this will change a lot. However, it's very, very bad for MasterCard's and PayPal's reputation. And that's kind of interesting.
Doesn't it frame the discussion about WikiLeaks as Julian Assange, who is already being called an enemy of the state in the American press, and now by Anonymous, which does not have a wonderful reputation in the mainstream media to begin with, as the internet vandal siding with the an American traitorous bastard, Julian Assange?
Well, you could call it like that, and yeah, in the eyes of some Americans, apparently he will be that. But in the eyes of a lot of people, they actually do understand it. It's kind of obvious that there's an uneven battle going on. Funds have been blocked. The website is under attack. People tend to forget that, but that's not Anonymous, but other people are doing that. Now you see that you can't get to money because Visa card and MasterCard refuse to use your credit cards to give money to WikiLeaks. So all in all, they are under continuous attack.
And PayPal, of course.
And of course, not to forget PayPal and Amazon. So yeah, I understand that some people get outraged. I don't know if it's fair, but I think they try to level the playing field and show that there is a whole community out there that is willing to attack.
On the other hand, several people have said what WikiLeaks is doing hasn't provided anything near to something comparable with the Pentagon Papers. It was something that happened in the 70s. It mostly confirmed what we already knew, that people feel that Sarkozy is a douchebag, that Angela Merkel is not a very unpredictable and creative person. Well, I mean, if you look at her picture, you already know that she's unlikely to be the next Picasso.
Well, you know, if you've got 250,000 documents and we are only just over 1,000 documents being that have been released up to so far, I think it's kind of early to jump to that type of conclusions. Sometimes having information acknowledged is news in itself. Like the Netherlands, we knew, kind of saw that we had nuclear bombs. Now we've got it confirmed, finally. It was one of the biggest public secrets ever. So that's a good thing. But on the other hand, I did not know that in Spain, the United States was writing the copyright law. That simple fact in a cable changes the vision. I did not know that China was kind of okay with Korea being reunited. So you can belittle this already, but I only think this is the beginning, and the real tension out of the US towards WikiLeaks is really aimed at other cables that are still not being released. So,
well, the two examples you're giving are hardly surprising to begin with. That China is uncomfortable with the unpredictable nature of the North Korean regime was already widely known. Did anyone?
Yeah, but it's a journalist's task to make sure and to get it verified and to get to the information that really proves it. And I think it's a good thing that we know it now.
it's nowhere near as revealing as the Pentagon Papers were, which showed that, for example, the involvement in the United States in the Vietnamese War was been much further than was previously was known. And in that sense, I haven't seen hardly anything new.
Well, don't forget the military logs that have been released, the amount of civilians where the U.S. knew that there were a lot of more people. In the past, we've seen the release of documents on the environment where ultimately it turned out that scientists were polishing results, at least it raises questions. A very Dutch case, the Probo Koala, the Trafigura case, those documents proved that there was this company and it was doing things that they have now been convicted for. Without WikiLeaks, there wouldn't have been a criminal trial. So I think up to so far, WikiLeaks has done a lot of good in improving crimes and abusive behavior. And it's way too early to give a final judgment. For the next couple of years, we are going to learn a lot of interesting things.
True. And one of the interesting things you mentioned, the so-called KIPR cables, which is the label for any cables in the trove, slowly being published by WikiLeaks or through WikiLeaks, how you put it, which is about IPR enforcement issues, ACTA, free strikes, you're out legislation, etc., etc. And what I found surprising was that WikiLeaks is in fact already being incorporated in the traditional media, because one of the issues the Spanish hacktivists have in influencing the Spanish legislative process is that WikiLeaks was only sharing this data with El País, which is part of a large media conglomerate and does not have a positive stake in revealing these specific cables. And WikiLeaks is not making any editorial choices themselves, but are still allowing the traditional media to make those editorial choices.
That's absolutely true. But at the end of the day, you need to make sure that the story gets out there. If they would have just put the 250,000 cables there, the chances of really getting good results really rapid, that's... I can understand that you're kind of careful there and that you want to have media organizations that are willing to make news out of it. That's, at the end, the aim of the disclosure, is that people start to talk about it like we do now.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is not so much that they have a vetting process, because if anything, they probably still don't have enough of a vetting process if you have this massive amount of data, and it's indeed still a likelihood of people being endangered by releasing raw data. The point I'm making is that they're mobilizing the vetting effort of traditional media and thereby applying the same filters as the traditional corporate-dominated media.
Well, but that's a result of what happened in the past, where you saw information being released and sometimes not being picked up by the mainstream media, and then it ends up in the activist community that is very angry, and that's just about it. Talking about that activist community and your earlier question, I'm now thinking that a lot of things we know already or suspect, like the influence of the US on IPR, that's very interesting, but we were always like, that's what they say and we can't believe that, and you know, you're seeing UFOs, and now it turns out that it's a hard fact that there is influence being done. So it does add value.
Okay, true that. Another thing I was rather surprised by was by the fact that some powers are using means that are usually associated with criminals, such as distributed denial of service attacks on the WikiLeaks site and on their DNS hoster. And as a result, some activists are starting to start a peer-to-peer DNS program.
And as you also see, of course, with our friends from the Pirate Bay.
And Telecomics.
Yes. That's a very interesting concept, what's what you see now happening on the internet is that there are some people out there that try to control it all, dominate it all, the United States, of course, being one of the leading nations. And now when they seem to be doing things with the power that a lot of people don't like, the community strikes back and says, if you can't handle it, we will. And basically, that is what's going down. There's an aim for power. There is a reach for the power on the internet. And I would welcome an alternative to the current DNS system. Because that would really make it harder to take websites offline. We've seen cases in the Netherlands where a Dutch journalist showed a death threat to a Dutch politician, and he didn't make the threat himself. He was just retweeting it and putting that tweet also on his blog, and then the Dutch government tried to take the blog down. That type of interference should stop. I mean, we are allowed to say that somebody is under attack. So
I'm hearing echoes of John Perry Barlow. This is cyberspace, and you people of the old world are not welcome anymore.
I think that is the basic battle that is going on, and I think that WikiLeaks is driving us into a new way of looking at information and how to deal with it, and a new way of dealing with governments.
Yes, interestingly enough, by the way, the US State Department is sponsoring an event about free press.
Yes, I've seen that, I've noticed that. I won't be there.
Neither will I. At least I haven't been invited, but I thought the there was a certain irony to that.
There's a very big irony there, because I don't feel safe going to the US at this point in time. And I'm not involved directly with WikiLeaks, but I'm just afraid of, you know, if you're in a circle, you might end up, you know, I'm in hacker circles, so I might end up on some list or whatever. So,
well, I've just seen Kuhn, who was part of his GMC Does America tour, has been passing TSA security checkpoints several times, and he's been complaining about not being fondled extensively enough by TSA agents.
That's a whole different issue with GMC there. I know, but it is. There's an irony there, and I don't feel at this point welcome as a journalist. By the way, the US has never been welcoming to journalists. You are allowed to travel for free because you're not a journalist. I am a journalist.
Well, in my current quality, but in an hour I won't be.
Yes. Well, but then you might need to have a visa to enter the US. That simple fact is strange because of the type of job you have. And that's so much for the land of the free press. So, no, I don't take them very seriously. The way they are dealing with the leaks now is highly immature. And they've been exaggerating the risks all the time. They've been claiming that people would die. They haven't delivered any evidence. So, no, I don't take it too seriously.
The two things I still would like to point our listeners to. There was an interesting editorial by Julian Assange on the website of The Australian. And, Google for that and you'll find it and read it. It's interesting indeed. He was saying, you can't have it both ways. This information is either very dangerous or it's very irrelevant, and according to the US State Department, it's both. And that can't be. Another one is the comments by Clay Shirky saying, WikiLeaks is too extreme in my opinion, but given the current state of freedom of the press, you need something extreme to put it back in a normal state.
I fully agree on the latter one. Yeah.
I found them interesting, at least. I still haven't made up my mind.
Well, you know, it's something that governments bring on themselves. What you see happening all the time is when you ask the government for clarification on very simple issues, you end up filing FOIA requests. If you file a FOIA request in the Netherlands, you've got to wait for 2 months. Last time I was asking for documents that were in digital shape on a website, and I was asking for other versions of those documents, and they were looking for that for 2 months. So you've got a digital document, and the Dutch bloody government can't find it. Well, if they can't find it, WikiLeaks can. So I understand where this is coming from, and I fully understand that at a certain point people say enough is enough. I'm in court literally all the time. You know, at least once a month, I've got a case going on. This can't be the reality.
Well, apparently it is. And coffee is lousy in Dutch courthouses, by the way, for those who have never been there.
Yeah, and
talking about court cases here in the Netherlands, by the way, and we shouldn't make it too much of a Dutch-centric program, there is a court case going on about a central database of fingerprints of all Dutch people.
Yes, we are in a very interesting exercise right now in the Netherlands. If you get a new passport, you have to give your fingerprints, and those will end up on the chip on the
and
passport.
And for our American listeners, the purpose of that is to make sure that your fingers are big enough to put them in a hole in the dikes. But other than that, it's also to be put on passports.
Yeah, I'm. You know, I don't want you to be talking about putting fingers in dikes. That's, you know, a dike on a bike, you know, you never know what you're going to get. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about fingerprints in the passport so that you can verify that somebody is really who's claiming to be. But the Netherlands want to embrace and extend a little bit. They add two fingerprints, and then all four of them end up in a database. The database hasn't been built yet, so decentralized at all city halls, there are now databases being, or collections of fingerprints.
Which I think is even scarier, given the general level of competence in Dutch municipalities than having a centralized database which was going to be outsourced to a French defense contractor. What could possibly go wrong?
Yes, well, that's the thing, you know, then they want to take it central and then it will be totally perfectly protected. Then there are stories that they want to be able to search the database so that they can recognize people, so you're using the information in a different way. It has a high level of a minority report. It was in court. It's being fought by a whole bunch of people, and so far the judge hasn't ruled yet, or actually the three judges. But basically on civil charges related to human rights, people are claiming this isn't needed, other countries aren't doing it, and it's highly dangerous. So yes, that's a very interesting project going on right now in the Netherlands.
Okay, we'll keep you tuned on the outcomes of that court case.
Okay. Well, I got to run, so...
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, good evening, Smari. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And what's the weather like in Reykjavik today?
It's cloudy, rainy, pretty boring.
Likewise in The Hague.
Yeah.
We met each other in Barcelona at the Free Culture Forum, and before that at the CCC Congress last year, and you're deeply involved in the Icelandic New Media Initiative. And just for our listeners who may not necessarily know what this is all about, just give a brief explanation what it is.
The Icelandic Modern Media Initiative is, or the International Modern Media Initiative as we're calling it now, because we're trying to expand the scope, is essentially an attempt to try and rethink how media law is functioning around the world. We started off by taking a look at the best media laws in various countries around the world and compiling them into a package that we suggested that the Parliament adopt here in Iceland. And now work is underway in the Ministry here to implement these as law. But in the meantime, it's going to take a couple of months for them to get started and a couple of years for them to finish. So we'll start to talk to other countries about maybe proliferating this model.
Okay, and proliferating to what countries?
We've currently been establishing groups in Italy and in Spain.
Okay, well, Alan Katz, Director of International Affairs of the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation. Very welcome on our show. You're in Oakland. I just asked Mari from the International Modern Media Initiative how the weather was in Reykjavik. I suppose it's a bit better in Oakland than in Reykjavik right now.
It's true, though it has been raining. It is generally lovely weather in the Bay Area.
But anyway, that was not the subject we were going to talk about. I've managed to interview Smari without even mentioning WikiLeaks, but I don't think we're going to avoid that, having a conversation about WikiLeaks with you, given that EFF is so much involved in freedom of speech, freedom of information, and the internet as a whole. What's the EFF's positions on the whole WikiLeaks saga and the frenzy surrounding it right now?
Well, put it succinctly, more speech is better speech when it comes down to calculation of the different interests in solving social problems. And I think what's transpiring is evidence of that, both in terms of public opinion and in terms of the law. I think that it's important to separate out the wisdom of publication and whether or not WikiLeaks publishing was a wise ethical maneuver, and even the question of the legality or illegality is actually completely unguided in terms of American precedent in court cases and arguments back and forth between constitutional scholars. So the issue that's, I think, very important for the development of the internet and for those who are interested in open infrastructure and internet freedom and civil liberties for individual internet users is that the freedom of expression is turns out to be, in the internet context, sometimes only as strong as the weakest intermediary, which is to say that we've got instances where the struggle to keep WikiLeaks online because of private actors without specific governmental requests choosing to take down material. Amazon with its cloud hosting service dropped WikiLeaks, and we see without much description of the process of how they came about to make this decision, or very vague reference to their terms of use as justification. And we had a miscommunication, PayPal, someone mentioned that at a conference, an executive said that they had actually been asked by the State Department to take down to not allow donations to be served to WikiLeaks. Well, it turns out that's not true. He was referencing a letter that Harold Coe, the legal advisor for the Justice Department, wrote to WikiLeaks about the legality. But nevertheless, the fact that for however many hours, and now in a released statement today, PayPal is explaining very little about their process, and in fact are out declaring that freedom of expression and human rights took no role in their deciding whether or not the terms of use were violated. I think that's a problem. I think it's a problem that human rights and freedom of expression and due process aren't considered necessary. And I think it's evident that there's public expectation that when companies make decisions regarding the speech that seems like it's in public space when it's on the internet, there should be at least some process, regardless of what kind of complaint it is. There should be at least some process in place to identify and make some decisions about whether or not it is what it's being claimed to be.
Yeah, one of the things I took away from this whole thing is that something which is not news at all is that in terms of payment processing, this is more or less dominated by free American companies. And this is kind of put in the limelight that for about any kind of transaction on the internet, especially on international transactions, the rest of the world is relying on Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal. And I found this kind of astonishing. I wouldn't be surprised if this would cause several other credit card companies arising, because I'm rather sure that other people have realized, well, if you do something which may be perceived as an issue in the United States, you may be cut off from your cash flows.
Yeah, I mean, I think there needs to be a lot more clarity about what they do. I'm not sure exactly what that means. The fact that the prominent virtual cash sort of distributors are American companies. But more so that they are the intermediary, which has a great deal of influence on the existence of an entity like WikiLeaks, and whether or not they'll pass on funds. It turns out that there's all sorts of independent, smaller organizations that are willing to and able to step in. But nevertheless, you see that the donation, you know, there's a lot of things on WikiLeaks, have been for many years. Cablegate is just the most recent thing, and we know from issues we've been following for a long time how things appear on WikiLeaks, and we witnessed, you know, on multiple occasions the ACTA-related issues made, you know, versions of drafts made it onto WikiLeaks. There's a whole host of things that make it onto WikiLeaks in regards to every country. It's not really picking on the U.S. I mean, this latest U.S. foreign policy and Iraq and Afghanistan war focus makes it seem so. But, you know, it's an equal opportunity, absolute transparency service. So it's just important to note, though, that cutting off the cash flow to an organization is overbroad, clearly, in the sense that there are all sorts of other activities that take place, and sometimes the money is distributed through, you know, some aggregate company or foundation, and so you'd be cutting off a whole bunch of other public interest philanthropy donations by trying to, you know, make a statement or cut off something having to do with only certain content on one of the websites served.
Yeah, in a sense, but on the other hand, I'm not sure whether you can expect governments to make that subtle distinction, even if you have politicians, especially when you have politicians shouting that Julian Assange should be hunted down like Osama bin Laden. And I think he should wish he was being hunted down like Osama bin Laden, because Osama bin Laden is still at large after 10 years, and Julian Assange is in a prison cell.
Yeah. I also think that you know, points been made about civil disobedience and the extent to which there is a risk always when challenging the status quo and the state of being that what you're doing may appeal to a higher moral ground, perhaps, but may still be illegal. That is not at all a conclusion or suggestion that their posting is the WikiLeaks postings are illegal. In fact, a memo produced by the Congressional Research Service, which is as impartial a research service in DC as you get, part of the government, in a study found that there haven't been any cases that would suggest that there is such criminal liability under the Espionage Act. So,
well, that's, you know, quite funny, though, because the analysis here in the Netherlands is that publishing the WikiLeaks cables may actually be punishable under Dutch criminal law.
Because I'd be interested to hear why.
Because it's classified information that affects a friendly nation, which is defined any nation we are not at war with. And there are quite a few although rather old articles in our penal code, which prohibit Dutch citizens from acting detrimental to the interests of friendly nations. There's even a specific clause saying you're not allowed to participate in a revolution against the regime in a friendly nation. And technically speaking, for example, Iran is a friendly nation of the Netherlands. The interesting bit is this part of the penal code is older than our participation in the Human Rights Convention,
right,
which overrides all this. But the case law available is not unequivocally clear on who whether it will be illegal or not.
So it makes it so that people aren't sure whether or not they can read the cables on their computers, whether at work or at home.
No, it's about publishing. And the interesting bit is there are right now three big mirrors of WikiLeaks in the Netherlands. Two of them are hosted by the Dutch equivalent of NPR. We have a rather different media system in which you have mostly publicly funded radio and television stations. And two of them are hosting a WikiLeaks mirror, one of them on the mostly right end of the political spectrum, one on the very liberal end of the political spectrum. And then you have a corporate WikiLeaks mirror, which is run by Access for All, which is the oldest Dutch ISP and initially a spin-off of Hectic magazine.
So how can they do that in light of the exposure to criminal liability, as you suggested?
The Dutch public prosecutor has indicated that they think it falls outside the scope of that piece of law that they've publicly said so far. But if you take a look at the law, it's a bit of a gray area, and they probably just don't want to burn their fingers on such a political case. But there has been some debate in Parliament about this already.
Well, I mean, it's also it's interesting to see how the legislative process and the judicial process makes its way through these areas where there's no precedent. But it does seem as though there's an element of political motivation behind those decisions judicially, whether or not to post. I just read yesterday of a Pakistani court in Lahore, the same one that banned all of Facebook for a period of a month during a time which there was an anti-Mohammed group that was a Facebook group, and they were running a contest of images regarding Muhammad that many Muslims found offensive. They blocked all of Facebook, and because they couldn't figure out how to block Facebook on the BlackBerry network, blocked all of the BlackBerry network as well. And this court now, in regards to a claim that the documents should be taken down or should not be made accessible, should be blocked. The judge said it's crucial and important that the truth come out, and that how could you question the pursuit of truth? And so it's just that
this is almost as ironic as the U.S. State Department sponsoring a UN event on freedom of expression.
Yeah, that's some poor timing on the part of some public relations people. But in fact, I looked and there was a difference between the statement made publicly by the State Department, the announcements on World Press Freedom Day. And this is something that happens every year. And there was not a new announcement. It was, leading up to it for a while. But then in the day's briefing, if you'll see the transcript, you see that the spokesperson says, yes, I do see the irony here. And it also coincides with a consultation that the telecommunications and NTIA research part and technology standards aspect of government had a consultation on the global free flow of information. And, you know, all of those documents and all those comments were, you know, were due right around the time of all this information coming out in regards to WikiLeaks. And I think the free flow of information is either welcome or threatening, depending on your political inclination at times, it seems, with a foreign policy that doesn't bridge and make consistent those parts that are about innovation and about foreign policy, and those parts that are about protection of cultural industries, et cetera, and trying to figure out a way to reconcile all those. And we've been talking for a while in the community of people interested in free culture and access to knowledge about the fact that openness and open architecture is not only more efficient and more productive, but it also involves more dignity to the individual. And I think that it's time to recognize that as part of the evaluation process that we see the different actors and the decisions that they make.
Well, I found, and I talked this with earlier on with Brenno de Winter, I found Clay Shirky's assessment of the situation very interesting, and his point was, you can be a human being in a complete and transparent world, and therefore you need privacy. And a government cannot act in a international community without having at least some form of secrecy. And in his opinion, the fundamental idea of WikiLeaks of exposing everything is fundamentally flawed. And I'm kind of tempted to agree with him. I'm still haven't made up my mind myself so far. There are several things that deeply scare me, though, and especially one of those is that apparently when MasterCard got knocked off the net by a distributed denial of service attack, their ability to process payments was affected as well.
For everyone. Yeah, first of all, we just put out, the Electronic Frontier Foundation put out a tweet just to make sure everyone understood that denial of service attacks are not the means of resolving these issues and these debates. I think the point is that government is necessarily in a position. We see all of the conflicts of interest, and we see, you know, all the embassies and all the diplomats kind of closing in. And while it is true that there is some secrecy necessary, and when we say free flows of information, that is not without any, you know, friction or without any internal decision making and all sorts of things that are necessary for communication, but that, you know, the over secrecy that's taken place, the just, you know, redacting of huge swaths of information from the public that has become the norm, sort of invites this countervailing reaction, which is to say that this the system that decides what's secret or not has no credibility. It reaches so far that things that you can't imagine and would be important to be in the public interest are being held secret. So I see it in those terms, and do not subscribe to the notion that there, you know, that all information should be made public, and there's no such thing as national security, and that there's no such thing as other social problems which have to do with media content that have to be addressed. Those definitely do. The question is whether or not these are going to be taken care of in back rooms or under democratic processes with consumer expectations met, that they're going to be treated with dignity and consistent with human rights when they're online.
I think that is a wonderful conclusion to our interview, Alan. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
And we'll probably be in touch later on.
Yes.
Okay, bye.